The campaign between Representative Dusty Johnson and his challenger, Cheryl Johnson. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, October 2nd. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we hear from the candidates for U.S. House. Democrat Cheryl Johnson describes herself as a farmer's daughter, a Navy wife, a mother, and a citizen fed up with Washington politics. Dusty Johnson is South Dakota's lone voice in the U.S. House of Representatives. He's a Republican, a former gubernatorial chief of staff, and a former telecommunications policy leader and public utilities commissioner. He's also a husband, a father, and the incumbent. We'll hear their policy priorities as well as analysis from our Dakota political junkies about the race for the House. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The race to represent South Dakota in the U.S. House of Representatives is in full swing. Democrat Cheryl Johnson is challenging incumbent Republican Dusty Johnson. We talk with both candidates ahead of their debate on October 15th.
I am Cheryl Johnson, and I'm running for the U.S. Congress seat currently held by Dusty Johnson. And I am running because I'm just fed up with the chaos in Washington. They don't get anything done. They fight. They don't bring up bills. They complain about the border, but then they turn away bills to do it. And so it's just been very ineffective. They've been the least effective legislature in our history. And so I'm just very frustrated. And I also am running because I want to give people a choice. He has not had Democratic opposition in 6 years. And I just thought it was time he could have a little competition.
Tell me a little bit about what qualifies you for the office.
Well, I've got a lot of life experiences, and he is basically a career politician. He's been in the political bubble the majority of his life. I have been a farmer's daughter. I've been a Navy wife. I've run a fabric store. I worked in a high school. I raised four daughters. I've volunteered in the community. I have got a lot of life experiences that I think would be good to go to Washington, and I can relate to the common person, the everyday working family, because I've been on that end. I was a working mom for a while. I was a single mom when my husband was deployed during the Gulf War. Was a stay-at-home mom for a few years. So I've just experienced a lot of stuff in life, and I feel like I have a lot of wisdom that might be helpful in Washington.
Would this be your first elected office?
If I win, it'd be my first elective office. I have run locally before. It was always great experiences because I really enjoy getting out and listening to the people about what concerns them. And so many people feel like nobody's out there listening to them. Yeah. So what I'm currently doing right now is I'm doing kind of a tour of part of South Dakota, and we are going to different towns, and we're listening to people. We're having meet and greets. We're finding out what's important to them. This last leg was Madison, and then we were in Webster, South Dakota, and we were in Vermilion, and then we were in Burke and Platte and Winter, and we stopped at Rosebud and Rapid City and Hot Springs. So we are just having a great time.
Tell me a little bit about some themes that you hear emerging from towns across South Dakota for what voters want.
A lot of voters are very frustrated because they feel like their voice doesn't matter. They elect someone to go to Washington and represent them, and then that person turns out representing special interest and doesn't get back to them. Or they have town halls, but it's on a phone and their questions don't get answered, and they're very frustrated with that. Cost of living is a huge thing I hear a lot about, the inflation and stuff like that, and people are struggling. Wages aren't keeping up with the prices of food, and people don't realize that the food companies right now are making record profits. So it's not necessarily the government's fault of inflation, but just people are frustrated.
What would you do differently? Because being the sole representative from the U.S. House of Representatives in Congress is a difficult thing. It's hard to build coalition. It's hard to, you know, get some of these things done. What would you do differently?
I'm going to represent the voice of the people. I feel like sometimes politicians start off thinking that, but then when they get there, they have to make more money. They are worried about running for their next election. And before you know it, they're catering to all the special interest because those are the ones that give them monies for their campaign. I am not running to be a career politician. I won't say my age, but I'm older than Dusty. And to start a career now, you know, if I can go in and get a couple terms, we've got great legislators coming up. We're building our bench, and they'd be great ones to take over. But I don't want to be in there till I'm 90, you know. So I'm running, and I'm running with the fact that I'm going to do the work of the people, to be a public servant. If I don't get reelected, I'm fine with that. I've got four grandkids I can retire and go play with.
As I look at your campaign page and follow you along the trail, you talk a lot about personal freedom. Mm-hmm. Let's start with your thoughts on personal freedom and healthcare.
Personal freedom and healthcare is the main reason I'm running. I have got four daughters, and I, like a lot of women, I felt very betrayed when Roe versus Wade was overturned. I totally respect people who have the belief that life begins at conception. And I think we need to protect everybody's beliefs and convictions as long as they don't infringe on other people. I do not like the fact that our politicians are using their personal beliefs to weaponize laws that take away other people's freedom. And what really drove this home to me was one day I got a call from one of my daughters, and she was calling from the hospital. She had just gone in, and she had just miscarried her first child. So, you know, I was heartbroken. I had a miscarriage years ago, and it's devastating. Well, then I found out the rest of the story and what had happened. This was like 2 weeks after Roe was overturned, and her state had had a trigger law where you could not have an abortion beyond 6 weeks, and she was like 12 weeks along. But she'd gone into the emergency room, and they allowed her to go home. And that night, my son-in-law found her collapsed on their bathroom floor, and she was so weak from blood loss, he had to call an ambulance to take her back to the hospital. So, of course, you know, I was heartbroken for my daughter, but then I was just really livid. I was really upset that our politicians put their personal beliefs and convictions into law, and that law put my daughter in danger. And we've already seen a couple cases where women have died because they were waiting to be bad enough to get the treatment they needed. I just am a strong believer that government should not have the power to make decisions for women.
You know, first of all, I'm terribly sorry that this happened to you. Mm-hmm. That's a very difficult thing to go through. Was there something that made you say this was directly tied? They used language that said we can't help you. Or do you think it was just a tragic health event?
I think it was, you know, it had just been overturned. I think the doctors might have been a little confused about, you know, what they could actually do. I mean, doctors are scared. I've got three physicians in my family, and it takes a long time and a lot of hard work to become a doctor. And they're being threatened with having their livelihood taken away if they break the law on some of this stuff. And they're there to help the patient. And I think sometimes they're like, well, gee, if I help the patient, you know, will I lose my license, stuff like that. So I don't think they intentionally wanted to put her in danger. I think maybe they thought she would be just fine. But it just goes to show you that stuff like this happens. And I think we need to just let women make their own choices and get the health care they need at the time they need it.
If voters send you to Washington, would you support legislation that would restore Roe v. Wade-style protections into federal law, or do you think that belongs in the state's purview?
My thought is I don't know why the states have the right for this. I don't know why a woman living in a red state should have fewer rights than a woman living in a blue state. So I do think this is a federal issue, and if I can go in and make laws that would keep government from having the power to make decisions for women, yes, I would do that. So I would codify Roe versus Wade. I think it was law for 50 years, and it shouldn't have been overturned.
Let's talk a little bit about immigration and border security, another really hot topic in Congress.
Okay.
Former President Donald Trump has said if he's elected again, he would call for mass deportations of unauthorized immigrants or people who are here illegally. What would you want to know in Congress if that sort of effort was coming out of the White House? What would one of your first steps be?
Well, I would oppose it because it could devastate our economy. We have got a lot of immigrants, even illegals, that are working jobs supporting our economy. I am out talking to a lot of small business people, and one of the biggest complaints they have is finding enough workers. And a lot of times we're basically turning business people into criminals because they have to hire somebody under the table, you know, to work in their fields or their dairies. The backlog at the border is one of the initial problems. It's a system problem, and we need to go down there. We need to put more money into judges. We need to vet their cases. We need to get them in and fill some of these jobs that are going empty that people are desperate to have workers for. They can become tax-paying citizens and help support our country. So I think the notion of just deporting all immigrants is a very naive topic. I mean, that would empty a lot of jobs. It'd almost be like the pandemic where all of a sudden you don't have people to work.
Do you think the resources and the logistics exist to carry it out? Would you want to know the price tag, for example?
I definitely would want to know the price tag, but I think that would be very high. And I just think of, God, what a mess it would be to try to enforce all that. You know, how do you round up all these people? How do you know who's, you know, in here illegally? And then are you going to prosecute the business owner that's currently hiring them? I just think it's a big mess. I just think let's fix the issue at the border. Let's get people in legally, because I do believe we're a nation of laws and people need to come in the right way. It's not fair to the immigrants who have come in the right way. So we do need to enforce that. But I'm really tired of all of this about how, oh, the immigrants are illegals and they're criminals and they're rapists and they're all this. And they're not. The majority of them are very good people. Their families, they're coming up here for a better life and an opportunity that all of our ancestors came to America for. And they deserve the same right of those opportunities as long as they come in legally.
Do you support the bipartisan border security bill that was in Congress, was being discussed earlier this summer?
I do. And that was very frustrating because it shows me that this is an issue that the Republicans, they just want to run on it. They don't want to fix it. They just want to have it so they can complain about it. And you know, my opponent has constantly sent out postcards telling his almost scaring his followers about how we have this national crisis at the border. But they were given an opportunity to make a lot of fixes for it, and they weren't even bringing it up. And to me, that's just very petty politics. That's not how our country's supposed to work. If they didn't like some of the issues in the bill, you got a chance to amend it. You can compromise. You can do stuff. But the fact that they weren't even willing to bring it up, that just shows me that they're just playing political football with this.
Tell me a little bit about what you consider your role as a candidate is in promoting civil discourse during this election cycle.
I think we need to get back to the days where you could agree to disagree on policy and you weren't each other's enemies. I just think we've had a lot of immature people and they get the airtime. It's like the squeaky wheel gets a grease, you know, so a lot of television stations, I think they're more in it for ratings. They want to show just, you know, the stark stuff, the stuff that just is shocking and to get people's viewers. And I think sometimes they want to keep their viewers angry. And that's just not what America is. We need to work together. And voters need to understand that they're not going to get their way 100% of the time. Because I hear a lot of voters say, well, if you don't vote for this, we're going to primary you next time or we're going to throw you out. They have to realize, too, that their representative represents everybody in the state of South Dakota and not just them.
Do you find a place of common ground with you and Congressman Johnson where you think, yes, this is something that we really agree upon?
Yeah, I do. I'm trying to think the top of my mind, anything else, but there have been some things he's done that I thought were good. And I do think for the most part, I mean, he started off pretty moderate. I've been frustrated because I feel like lately he's just towing the party line because he's got his eye on the governor's seat. We all know he's going to run for that. And that's kind of frustrating to me, too, because I'm like, you know, telling voters, would you want to elect somebody that is going to be spending the next 2 years in office raising money and running for governor? You know, how focused is he going to be on our state or is he focused on his career?
There's one more topic that's important to you that I think we should address, and that is a ballot question about pipelines and who has the right for eminent domain. Tell me a little bit about why this issue is important to you.
Well, I grew up on a farm, and my family in the 1980s, we lost our farm. I also saw an uncle was injured in a severe farming accident, and he ended up losing his dairy herd, his dairy operation, and the farm that had been in our family for 100 years. So growing up as a farm girl, I know the value that land means, what it means to farmers. This law, this RL21, the ethanol companies and the Carbon Summit pipeline, they're trying to present it like it's going to be good for economic growth. It's going to help the corn and stuff. What it's going to do is help the ethanol owners and investors. They are the ones that are going to make the money from this. They're going after these carbon capture credits to make more money. They want to put these carbon CO2 pipelines into the ground. And I've heard tons of stories from these farmers about how they have been so bullied and harassed by this company. They don't want these pipelines in their grounds because CO2 can be a very deadly gas. If it leaks or explodes, people within miles of that leak or explosion could be killed. And they don't want their families exposed to that. They also are talking about using some of this CO2 and piping it up to the North Dakota oil fields where they would extract more oil from fracking. So basically, it's a taxpayer subsidy for the fossil fuel companies so they can get more oil out of the ground. To me, it's just a big transfer of wealth from the taxpayers to the ethanol companies. And it also takes away the local control of county commissioners. But it's written in such a confusing way on the ballot. It makes it sound like it's going to be a landowner. You know, they're going to get paid for these pipelines and all this stuff. Well, in the bill, it says they may get paid. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to. I encourage people to vote no on RL21. It's not a landowner bill of rights. It's a Carbon Summit bill of rights.
Early voting has begun. Cheryl Johnson is running for the U.S. House of Representatives as a Democrat against the incumbent Congressman Dusty Johnson. Cheryl, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Lori. Good talking to you again.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We're talking about the race for South Dakota's lone U.S. House seat today. Before the break, you heard from challenger Cheryl Johnson. She's a Democrat. Later in the hour, you'll hear from incumbent U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson, the Republican. Our Dakota political junkies connected with us from the Janine Basinger studio at South Dakota State University. They discussed the role of a challenger against a popular incumbent in a race like this. Lisa Hager is an SDSU Associate Professor of Political Science, and David Wiltsey is a Professor of Political Science, also at SDSU.
For any incumbent, we kind of have this sense that there should be an opposition, there should be a challenge to any incumbent's stay in office, and a lot of people just think that that competition keeps them honest, keeps them on their toes, and keeps them connected to their constituency. The fact is, in most races, we don't have much of an opposition. We don't have much of a challenger. And a whole passel of these things go uncontested. And there really isn't any systematic evidence that the quality of representation is better or worse. And I think in this case, you could make a pretty good case that Dusty Johnson has done a very good job keeping connected to his constituency. Polling shows that he's one of the most popular politicians in the state, if not the most popular politician in the state. And I don't think there's a great deal of harm that comes from even token opposition or moderately strong opposition. Yeah. It's just it just kind of violates a sense that a lot of people have of how democracy ought to work.
Right. There's money at stake, too. You have to, if you don't have an opponent, you don't really have to spend any money, and therefore that money builds and builds, right?
That's a factor, and that money builds into a war chest that can stave off more opponents. But for the most part, money is not a huge obstacle for people who are running for office, particularly if that race is in a competitive state or competitive district. Okay. Money tends to find its way into those races.
So, Lisa, with that in mind, you can either add to that, but also I'm wondering then what a challenger's job is. Is it about believing that you can win and really making, you know, chipping away at a candidate that you think is vulnerable?
I think it depends what it is your goal is in running. So there's some who just want to expose some particular issues with a candidate, particularly the incumbent, by saying, hey, these are the types of issues that they aren't paying attention to, or they aren't representing their constituents' sincere interests in. But then there is obviously that component of, well, if you're going to run, you should believe that you can win by making some of those arguments. You may realize, though, that the cards are stacked against you, so you can't necessarily have as much opportunity to win as you'd maybe want. But if you can try to chip away slowly but surely and try to continue to show some of these things, that can be helpful for you.
The issue of abortion is on the South Dakota ballot, and Challenger Cheryl Johnson is also making it number one in what she's talking about with voters. How does an issue, a ballot question like abortion, impact the race, Lisa?
I think it can have an impact because it's definitely an issue that's at the top of voters' minds. So knowing that they're going to be going to the ballot box and needing to make a decision on a particular policy issue, but also evaluating different candidates on a variety of policy issues, that being one of them, if that is an issue that's important to them, I think that is something that will impact their vote choices, not just on the ballot initiative question.
Dave, do you think a Democratic candidate in South Dakota can ride the wave of abortion support to make inroads against Dusty Johnson?
Not much. It might get a few points. It might give you a little bit of a bump, but we would have to overcome some serious, serious obstacles for that challenger, because he is an incredibly popular politician, despite the fact that South Dakotans are very evenly divided on the question of abortion. It's not salient enough for most people to change their partisan preferences. I would be stunned if this would prove to be that powerful a boost.
It would be a major upset.
Oh, yeah.
And that's safe to say, yeah.
Yeah.
We can't call a race, but it would be a major upset. We would definitely be talking about that the next day. What happened if Cheryl Johnson defeated?
Oh, for sure.
We would be talking about that, and I would be pulling as fast as I possibly could to try to figure that one out.
Yeah. Lots of people have said on the show that everyone expects Dusty Johnson to run for governor in the future, and Cheryl Johnson has made this part of her campaign as well, where she has said, does he even want to be in Washington? I want to be in Washington. He wants to come home and be governor. Lisa, does he have to answer that question yet?
I think because it's something that's getting brought up, he is going to probably answer it in some sort of way, but I suspect it will be a diplomatic, wishy-washy kind of way in order to diffuse the comments that she's making, you know, something along the lines of, if I didn't want to be in Washington, I wouldn't be running for re-election, so on and so forth, maybe just talking about things relating to wanting to do the good work for the people of South Dakota, which still leaves the door open for him possibly running for governor, but still making the point that he's focused on what he's doing right now, which is running for House.
Yeah. Dave, anything you would add to that about a potential shakeup and how we're hearing, you know, people just constantly throw out names for the gubernatorial race 2 years from now?
Much of what Lisa just said, but also for a position in the House of Representatives that is 2 years, fine. I mean, if he wants to run for governor in 2 years, why not? But we can come up with a list of a lot of potential quality candidates for that office. And you just look at all the statewide offices there, the constitutional offices and whatnot. And in many respects, I don't think people care too much about that.
Yeah.
And just like, you know, people try to make a big deal of Kristi Noem's apparent national ambitions on this, that, and the other. It doesn't really gain traction. And I think if it doesn't gain traction in her case, where she is the governor and she is at the head of government, I don't think that's as impactful when it comes to a member of Congress.
Lisa, I heard a super interesting feature on NPR talking about Donald Trump running for office now and showing up for all these podcasts with male hosts and just having chats with male podcast hosts about everything from, have you ever been in a fistfight, Mr. President? Just shooting the breeze with the idea that he was going after young men, trying to get them to come to the polls. And some of these hosts have millions and millions of listeners. They're influencers. Have you noticed the role of influencer? We know Taylor Swift has endorsed Vice President Harris. Do influencers matter?
This is a really funny question that you're asking me, because yesterday in my American presidency class, my students actually brought up influencers.
Nice.
Because we were talking about celebrity endorsements and whether we think that they matter in terms of elections in general, but especially in an election like this where it just seems like quite a few people already have their minds made up. Mm-hmm. And then they started talking about all these influencers, which frankly, I did not know who really any of them were. But a lot of them mentioned how they thought some of them were with audiences of middle school boys and whatnot. And so I thought that was kind of interesting, especially based on what you were saying with Trump going on these podcasts with a lot of male hosts trying to get males to be voting this election. So, yeah, I haven't come across anything that tells us about what the role of influencers are. I told my students for their research project that would actually probably be a good question.
Yeah.
And so I think that's something that remains to be seen, and it just plays into how presidential elections have evolved over time from the use of television to then the internet and social media. And now we're talking about social media influencers.
Yeah. I had a friend tell me this weekend, a friend from high school, that his college roommate had a Donald Trump poster hanging up back in college. And he's obviously my age. And it took me back to that time frame, the late 80s, early 90s, where Donald was a brand. The thing that they said, you know, they aspired to because he was positioning himself to be powerful at the time. I thought, gosh, I hadn't thought much about how we knew him when we were young.
He still is a brand.
Yeah,
and he's
right.
still making the same basic appeals that he was back in the 80s. And I remember this very well. I mean, he'd show up on Letterman and these other things, just kind of pop in. He was just kind of a social butterfly in the New York scene there, especially the New York tabloids. That's natural to him. And very carefully picking his media and picking his media based on who that audience is. And I think they have a sense at the Trump campaign that they are facing a bit of a swell when it comes to women getting engaged in this election, and they had better counter that. And if it's with kind of the dude bro incel crowd, well, so be it. And that's where he's targeting right now.
Interesting. Let's talk about something else. I sent you an article or two that I've been paying attention to about political violence. Maybe you want to discard those articles and say they're not relevant. If so, go for it. But I'm curious what you thought of them as we look at two alleged, well, one for sure, and I think the other one's still being adjudicated, but these attempted assassinations on candidate Trump and different acts of political violence. The research, from what I'm seeing, is a bit mixed as far as whether this is actually growing or decreasing. Where do you want to begin with this conversation?
The article that we saw coming from the university, researchers from the University of Chicago, was pretty alarming. And they are kind of tracking this slow rise amongst a pretty small fraction of our electorate that doesn't discount the use of violence. Just yesterday on NPR, heard another report coming from a group of researchers at Dartmouth that were saying it's probably smaller than what this Chicago group says.
Yeah.
But the point is, there is a group of Americans who don't reject the use of political violence. And that is troubling because it violates a very important democratic norm. We can debate whether this is new or whether it's old or if it's growing. But we can't deny that it is a part of our system. And we have dealt with this a lot in the past, and we will deal with it more in the future. And it's not something that's exclusive to the left or to the right. It's just a little more clean and clear where it's coming from on the right as opposed to the left.
There are people who said willingly that they thought violence was appropriate to keep Donald Trump from the White House. And there were other Americans who said violence was appropriate to install him back into the White House.
I think that if anything, what's interesting is just that we have political violence being something that we're talking about, that we're having to deal with, and then discussions about what that means in terms of politicians and what they're saying when they're campaigning or doing other public appearances, and how that could really encourage some folks to possibly want to engage in political violence. Obviously, it's very difficult to actually prove that somebody is actually inciting political violence at times, but there's definitely things that can get said that can encourage some of these folks to act or to even just have this viewpoint in the first place that says that it's more acceptable to engage in political violence.
Lisa, where is the line between You know, is it okay to say your political opponent is a threat to democracy, or is that language that leads to behavior that is illegal and violent?
I think it depends on the candidate themselves, how willing they are to use different rhetoric. Donald Trump has been one in particular when he has been facing impeachment attempts, where he says, I use the word fight, so do Democrats. It's mm-hmm. just a term that we use to really talk about how passionate we are about basically what we're fighting for. We're not saying yeah. actually do anything in particular. So what ends up being the issue is not only do you have to say something that is inciting or causing this sort of behavior, but also that by saying it, you know you are going to be causing that to happen. And that is very difficult to actually pin down. Yeah. Is that someone actually knew, if I say this, the following will be the result of it?
Yeah. There is also perhaps a cooling down effect of the prosecutions after 2020, prosecutions after January 6th. Dave, do consequences make a difference? When the rule of law plays out after the dust is cleared, will people remember that certain actions had consequences for the people who went out and broke windows and stormed a Capitol?
Perhaps. But also remember that they are listening to a campaign that's telling them, well, I'm going to pardon all of you when I'm reelected. Mm-hmm. And that kind of lowers those consequences, right? If you have this sense that if I go out, play my part, I'm not going to have to pay that price if we're successful. So I don't know. It's just a rhetorical trap that doesn't say anything good about our system right now.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. In the race for the U.S. House of Representatives, Congressman Dusty Johnson is the incumbent. He says he has specific goals for his next term, should voters send him back to Washington.
I mean, I'm a meat and potato guy, and a lot of my colleagues, they seem to be most interested in howling at the moon. And I've never seen that that's actually all that effective. And so you look at something like inflation and the border. These are legitimate issues. I think the way that we're talking about them makes progress a lot harder, because we're trying to turn everything into a holy war of blame. And so I'd actually like to get some progress made in both of those areas. And I think after the election, we're going to the temperature is going to cool a little bit. People will understand that we actually do have to address these issues. And I actually think progress is going to get a lot more likely. I would also say rural America still continues to get overlooked by both parties too much. And so I'd like to get a farm bill done. I'd like to make sure that we're doing an even better job in rural broadband, and that ag-based energy is an even bigger part of our country's future.
Are there things that you feel you are pointing to for voters now that say, here are my accomplishments, here's why you should send me back to Washington? Because it is a difficult environment to function in as the lone representative from South Dakota.
Yeah, I had a friend yesterday say, you are just not talking enough about what you've actually gotten done. And so, I mean, it was good counsel, and thank you for the question, because I do think when you interview for a job, if it's a job that you've had before, it's a perfectly legitimate question for the boss to say, you know, were you very good the last time we hired you? And rather than me bloviate, I guess I would just point to, you know, an independent third-party verification. The University of Virginia every 2 years analyzes who in Congress actually gets things done in a variety of different issue areas. They found that I'm the most effective office in Congress in dealing with agricultural issues, number one among Republicans, number five in getting things done on transportation and infrastructure, number nine in public lands issues, and number nine out of tribal affairs. And there's just not a single other office that scores that high in that many different areas. In the House, because there are 435 of us, most people have to really specialize in one issue. And a lot of those issues, Lori, are obviously, you know, very related. They're all very linked to rural America. So there is a specialization there for us. But when people who are nonpartisan and care about data look at the data, They say that we have been very, very effective.
What are you hearing that is important to voters? Do your accomplishments match with what you hear from South Dakotans they want?
No, when we don't do a lot of polling because it's expensive, and I sort of feel like you get a better vibe when you're wandering around the ball game or at church or at the grocery store. But when we do polling, it is amazing how little voters care about effectiveness, about competence. Now, there's still things I talk about because, listen, that's who I am. I mean, at some point, if you're X, you can't go tell people you're Y. I just think that lack of authenticity, it doesn't work. Our system really demands a certain authenticity. And so I talk a lot about competence and effectiveness, but we are living in an era, an angrier era, where all other things being created equal, most primary voters on either side of the aisle just as soon vote for the angriest candidate.
So what's your responsibility then, or how do you, as a leader of your team, your campaign team, say, we want to keep people engaged all the way up until Election Day and beyond, but our goal is not to keep people angry all the way up to Election Day and beyond?
Yeah, there is no substitute for modeling good behavior. And so I don't stoke a lot of fear and anger. Of course, like all of us, I am sure that I fall short of perfection. But I think when you do look, when you listen to interviews I do, when you see the public speeches I make, when you look on Facebook, we grade ourselves on making sure that there's a lot more constructive rather than destructive rhetoric. And although I don't get an A+, I do feel our team feels really good about the fact that we do not stoke the fires of hatred that unfortunately are all too present in our current political environment.
Yeah, I want to circle back to that in a minute. But first, let's pull out a couple things you said about inflation and immigration. Your opponent says food companies right now are making record profits. She's using that as a part of the narrative about why prices are so high. What is your response to what's going on with inflation right now? We know it's going down and we know wages are going up, but that doesn't mean people can afford their grocery bill. Help explain that to voters from your perspective.
Yeah, I mean, the data does matter. And the reality is that the returns on the investment of food companies are not disproportionate to what you see across the broader market. The idea that like the fix is in and every single company in the world, not just in America, but in the world, has all decided they're going to price gouge is absolutely without any evidentiary support. Of course, when prices are high, we look for a boogeyman. But what the overwhelming consensus of economists across the political spectrum acknowledge that, not surprisingly, dumping $12 trillion of governmental spending into one end of the funnel at a time when we have worker shortages, when you, in essence, distort both the supply and the demand side, that is going to impact prices. It is an unbeaten law of economics. And so we can talk about this in a way that tries to create a boogeyman, or we can acknowledge that clearly governmental spending has an impact on inflation. And I just think we're a lot more likely to deliver reasonable prices for people if we use the forces of supply and demand to our benefit rather than to demonize them.
All right. How so? What's the solution going forward, the policy solution to address inflation in America?
I mean, we have to have more supply. If we're going to be in an area of increasing demand, you have to have more supply. And of course, we all know this. I mean, middle school kids know this, right? If you've got two things and five people who want them, the price of those two things is going to get really high. And the people who own the two things might make some pretty good money, but that is how we, in this world, deal with scarcity. I mean, if you've got five people who want two things, there are only three ways you can deal with that scarcity. You can have a lottery, you can have people line up, and whoever gets in line first gets them, or you can use price to try to whittle the five demand down to the two supply. And so if we want to not use a lottery, not use lines, and not use higher than acceptable prices, we have to increase the supply of those items to five. And unfortunately, we've got a lot of regulations. We've got a lot of worker shortages. We have a lot of constraints in the supply chain that is making it really difficult for us to get food and clothing and equipment and supplies to the market. And let's be honest, the strike today at the ports in the eastern United States and the Gulf Coast are going to make things markedly worse in the weeks to come.
So have we recovered from the pandemic supply disruption, and these are new supply disruptions, or are they connected?
We have largely recovered from the pandemic. I mean, that being said, there were people who just decided during the pandemic that they didn't want to work, or that for some reason that they couldn't work. And although most of them have come back, particularly for men, the workforce participation rate has not come all the way back. If I'm remembering the data right, it has come all the way back for women. It has not come all the way back for men. And there's no particular reason why that would have to be the case. I do think there are some things we can do with education, with training, with how we deploy some of these welfare programs to try to make sure that people who can work are working. I do think work is opportunity. It's not punishment. And of course, we also need to be more creative. There are lots of folks who have some challenges, who have some disabilities. We could help them get into the workplace more easily. Of course, we've got older Americans that sometimes we punish through reducing the size of their Social Security check when they work too much. That's an antiquated policy we should change. And there are also some things we can do to make it easier for younger workers to get into the workplace. And then, of course, our legal immigration system is Byzantine, expensive, inefficient, and makes it way too hard for law-abiding people to get here and to live the American dream.
All right, let's talk more about that. Do you feel like you were close with the bipartisan immigration bill earlier this year that was put on hold? Clearly, people have criticized it for being put on hold for political reasons, saying, you know, there was a solution, and the political will just wasn't there for the solution until after an election. First, do you agree with that? And second, what do you think happens after the election with that bipartisan immigration bill?
I never came to the House, so I wouldn't call myself an expert on it. I mean, I understand what it would do. And I applaud Senator Sinema, Senator Langford, others for negotiating it. I believe they negotiated in good faith. Honestly, though, it just wasn't a very good deal. It just didn't actually tackle any of the major problems we have at the border. And people want to act like it died just because of the election. I think that's balderdash. I think the evidence will be that after the election is in the rearview mirror, and we know who controls the House and the Senate and the White House, it's that particular bill is still not going to go anywhere. It didn't address asylum. It didn't address catch and release. It didn't address things like remain in Mexico. It just, so many of the things that we know are broken at the southern border, it was too complicated by half. And because I think there were very smart people negotiating it, I think they wrapped themselves around the axle on some of these details when in the reality, we need to tackle the major problems or else it's just not going to have any real political momentum to get passed.
Former President Donald Trump has promised mass deportations. What do you need if he is elected president? What would you need to know in Congress about the logistics, the price tag of that policy?
Well, people who are here illegally shouldn't be here. And that, I mean, we're a country that values the rule of law. That that has been a bipartisan value for a long time. I think it's still true that no president has deported more people than Barack Obama did. And so I do, because of the way that Donald Trump conducts himself, there does, I think, with the folks on the left, there can sometimes be a visceral reaction to the things that he does. And I think sometimes, and of course, this is not just for the Democrats, Republicans often act reactively and in a negative way toward people on the other side as well. But in this instance, I mean, Barack Obama added 200 miles of border wall at the southern border, and it was not particularly controversial. But Donald Trump does it, and it's an existential threat to the American way of life, some claim. Barack Obama deports people. The left doesn't particularly seem all that bothered by it, the mainstream left. Donald Trump does it. All of a sudden, it's evil and vicious. And maybe there are ways that the two of those gentlemen conducted those behaviors that we can talk about, like nuance matters, details matter. But if somebody's here illegally, or if somebody has committed a crime, deporting them, that is the law of the land. That's what our laws say. And so I'm not, I mean, I don't get all that concerned about people who've broken the law getting deported. But obviously, that is a far more hyper-partisan topic than it was a few years ago.
So this phrase, mass deportation of unauthorized immigrants, or mass deportation into get, you think that's just keying people up a little more than it necessarily has to be? Because getting rid of people who are here illegally is more complicated than just, you know, working through the, like, how, who, when, how do we identify them? How do we find them? So help guide us through how you would handle that conversation, or how you have been handling that conversation, frankly.
Well, I mean, first off, I think there are two really important data points we have to remember. I mean, we've got 8 million people who have entered this country through the southern border in the last 4 years. That is a big, big number. Those are the ones that we've apprehended. There are clearly some gotaways or some people who maybe evaded notice, but we know about 8 million. We know that when those folks eventually get their credible fear hearing to determine whether or not they are a legitimate asylum seekers, whether or not they are indeed refugees, the overwhelming majority are going to fail that credible fear test. What they want is a better economic future. And that's a beautiful thing. It's just there's a different line for that. There's a different process. You don't get to pay the drug cartels $10,000 a person, cross the southern border, claim you're a refugee, and not actually be a refugee. And so I think the question that all decent people have to ask is, okay, if 90% of those people fail their credible fear hearing, 90% times 8 million is 7.2 million people. What are we to do with them then? Now, Barack Obama viewed a similar fact set and decided that those folks needed to be deported. I mean, those were, I guess, mass deportations. And I think if Donald Trump is interested in doing much the same thing for those 7.2 million people, I think we have to ask, why is our reaction to his policy so different than what the reaction was to Barack Obama's policy?
It's really hard to prove credible fear if you're running from something. You and I have talked about this before, just the difficulty of, you need evidence.
Well, it is a fact-based determination, and of course it should be, although I do think judges approach this with a lot of empathy and with a lot of understanding. But we also, I mean, there are a billion people, Lori, who want to come to this country, at least. And so if we can have one of two approaches, we can say either everybody who wants to come to America, come to America. Now, I would oppose that. I don't think having a billion people move here is probably going to be in the best long-term interest of America and Americans. So then if you're not going to say yes to everybody, then you have to say, okay, how do we have a compassionate, common sense immigration policy that is going to serve the best long-term interests of this nation? And that is going to mean telling some people no. And that is never a very comfortable thing to do, but I think no is less dangerous than saying, you know, yes 100% of the time.
Yeah. That was U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson. The debate between Dusty Johnson and challenger Cheryl Johnson, broadcast October 15th at 8 p.m. Central Time on SDPB-TV. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.